This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tamotu, MPR.
Kia ora, you're with Rachel Doré, bringing you words from the bubble on MPR. Te reo Irirangi on a tangata o Manawatu. The other day, I was talking to a friend in the Wairarapa, and she knows about the program. She listens to Words from the Bubble, and she said, "You must meet Jared Gullion. He has been writing a novel, and as it got published, he found out someone else, another author, had the same title as his. And that's an interesting issue. It was interesting for me because my novel is at the editors at the moment. And someone that I showed the thing to said they didn't like the title, the manuscript title at all. So I spent weeks vexing about this and going through Google, checking every title thing I came up with that no one else had it. And there's Jared Gullion, not bothering with that. He's going to stick to his guns. He likes his title. So I thought I'd track him down. And I have. And he's with me this minute. Welcome to Words from the Bubble, Jared Gullion.
Thank you, Rachel. It's a pleasure to be here. I was delighted to get the invitation. Thank you so much.
Now, tell us the story about this doppelganger title.
Well, it's pretty shocking. I've been working on this science fiction novel for about 3 years. And 3 years ago, I pored over possible titles. The primary character is The Last Beekeeper. It takes place in a near future world where there's a global bee crisis. And he practices traditional beekeeping. He doesn't like that the modern pollination has been taken over by giant corporations called bee lords. So he is literally the last beekeeper, which is the title of my novel. And so I've been working with this title for 3 years now. And I've now just got it to the point where I'm about to publish it. It's intended, originally I planned for it to come out at the end of August. And I put it up on Amazon for pre-order. I'm an independent author, so I'm self-publishing this. My first book was published traditionally, but now I'm moving through to independent publishing. And after I put it up on Amazon to get it ready for pre-order, which is now up there for pre-order, I learned that there is another book. HarperCollins is publishing a book called The Last Beekeeper, by a woman named Sia Turabi, and it was scheduled to come out the same week as my book. I was gutted, of course, when I heard this. Now, it is actually a different genre. Sia Turabi's book is sort of an international fiction. It's compared to The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini. So it's a very different genre. Mine is a near future sci-fi thriller. But my first instinct was, I have to change my title. I don't want people to be confused and buy my book. So that was my first instinct. I had to change it. And I did some research. And I learned this is not as uncommon as, this is much more common than you would think. It happens quite a bit. There's many examples. An interesting example is there's a woman named Emily Schultz who published a novel called Joyland in 2006. Then along comes Stephen King in 2013. He published a novel called Joyland. And suddenly Emily Schultz was having people accidentally buy her book. And unfortunately in her case, they were leaving bad reviews because they had bought the wrong book. Now hers had been out for 8 years. She actually started a blog called Spending Stephen King's Money because she was making more money than ever because people were accidentally buying her book. That's just one example, but there's others. Two books came out in 2013, 1 week apart, both called Life After Life. There's often in the same genre, there's two books called I See You that are both thrillers, one written by the author of the Orphan X thrillers. So it's actually not uncommon. And I've learned that titles typically, you can't copyright a title. They can be trademarked if there's merchandise involved, like Harry Potter. But titles happen repeated more than you'd think. So I decided that I would not change the title of my book because I'm so wed to the title. It is about The Last Beekeeper. It's a different genre. I am making some changes. I'm adding, my book is the first part of a series. So I'm adding, the Vespling series book one to the cover so that it will be really clear to people. And I'm also changing the release date so it's not coming out the same week as the other. I'm actually moving my release date to now it'll come out in mid-July. So I'm making some changes, but keeping the title.
Good for you. So it's just, you just shrug and say, well, that's life. It's just how it is.
Yes, it is. It is. There's, it is life. And I realized when I was looking at other titles, none of them quite hit the mark for me. And so I'm sticking to my guns. The Last Beekeeper is a great title for a near future sci-fi thriller. I really came to the point that as long as I'm really taking extra effort to make sure that people won't accidentally buy my book, that's my biggest concern. Because surprisingly, even though, my name is not Sia Turabi, people bought, Emily Schultz's book when they meant to buy a Stephen King book. They just saw the title and bought it. So people do sometimes make mistakes, but I feel that by adding the fact that it's part of a series will really help. So, yep, I'm sticking to it. I'm being brave. I'm saying that's all right, even though there's a global release of something from a major publisher coming out, within a month or so of mine. I am sticking to it, and we'll see what happens.
Very David and Goliath.
Yes, it is a bit. It is a bit. Somebody said to me, well, unless you have the marketing spend of a global publisher, then perhaps you should change your title. I do not have the marketing spend of a global publisher, but I do have a title that works very well for my book. And it is a very different genre. Mm. If it were the same genre, I would be more concerned about it. But given that mine is clearly, and I'm putting in the book description very upfront, that it's a sci-fi thriller so that people know.
Yeah.
Because the worst case scenario is that they buy it on accident and they leave me bad reviews, as Emily Schultz got bad reviews for her book, which had been out 8 years because it wasn't Stephen King's book.
Wow. That's not very clever of people either, is it?
No, it is not.
No, it's not.
It's one thing to accidentally buy the book, but then to leave a review criticizing the book because you bought the wrong one, it's not very smart. And so she jokes in her blog, she said that, I have to live with these bad reviews because Amazon won't take them down. So I'm going to make a big thing out of spending Stephen King's money. And she accounted for every cent that she spent. She put photos up. She bought herself a new laptop because the laptop she was writing on was old and decrepit. And so she bought herself a nice fancy new laptop. And she had a running total of all the royalties she'd made off of Stephen King and how much she'd spent. So much so that Stephen King actually put a tweet out saying, Emily Schultz is my new hero, good on you, or something equivalent to that.
Oh, that's graciousness for you.
Yes.
So tell us a bit more about The Last Beekeeper, your book, the sci-fi. Tell us just a little bit more about that.
So my book takes place on a remote island in Lake Michigan. It's based on a real place that I've visited on a family holiday. And it's interesting that the main character is somebody who's gone through some family trauma, and he's retreated from the world, and he's practicing, he's a beekeeper on this island, and he's there with his daughter. He lost his wife years previous, and he's very protective of his daughter and trying to keep her safe. And it's really a family drama to some extent, the relationship between this father and daughter, as something happens where there's something in the woods and people start disappearing. And he finds something very strange in his beehives, and he begins to unravel a mystery of what's going on to figure out what's in the woods killing people and what's in his beehives. And he starts to join up with a local detective and try to solve the mystery as people are being attacked in the woods.
Ah, it sounds as if you know something about bees and beekeeping.
My partner kept bees for quite some time, and I have become obsessed with them. Unfortunately, we no longer have bees on the property because my partner had an anaphylactic reaction at one point. So we got rid of those bees. But I have been reading about beekeeping for many years, and I've become somewhat obsessed with it. And so it sort of joined up when I've started thinking about what would happen if there were, already there's a huge problem with a colony collapse disorder where bee populations are dying. But what would happen if that went even further and there was a global bee crisis and bee and insect pollinated fruits and vegetables became increasingly rare? How would that impact the global food supply? Mm-hmm. And also I've done reading about how various people are looking at how do we remedy the situation? There's obvious things like arguing for a reduced use of pesticides. Some people are looking at making small mechanical drones that would do pollination. Others are looking at genetic modification. There's a lot of different scientific approaches to how we would solve this problem and make sure that it doesn't get any worse. So that just took me down a path, and I started thinking about this story about a father and his daughter on a remote island.
Right. I can see where it went, how it went there. So a series. Yes. So is the series,
yes,
is that going to have the same characters on the same,
yep,
quest?
It will be this the protagonist, the last beekeeper, will be throughout them. I imagine that there will be about four books. I'm working on the second book now. The second book is called The Brood Chamber. The brood chamber is a term used in beekeeping. It's where the young bees are reared in a beehive, but it is, you know, kind of atmospheric brood and all of that. So that's the second book I'm working on now, and the first book I'm working on these stories so that each has its own story arc, but then there's a bit of a cliffhanger that brings someone into the next book.
Mm. How exciting! Now,
well, I'm having a lot. Fun.
You're having a lot of fun. That's the most important, yes, thing. And I'm sure when you have a lot of fun or invest your life in a fun way into any work of art, I think it translates, doesn't it? It comes off. Yeah.
Well, and I'm hearing, I've got it, the book is now out with beta readers. I'm getting some beta feedback to make some final changes before I publish it. And I'm hearing great feedback from my beta readers. They're all asking me, what's going to happen to this character? What's happening with that character? Yeah. And I'm really getting some positive feedback. So I think that fun has translated.
Yeah, it's nice when that happens. So are your beta readers in New Zealand or in America? Or is it a mixture?
Both.
Both.
It's a mix. It's a real mix. Yes.
I'm interested in that.
Here from back in the
States. You've been here 16 years, you told me. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Yep.
So,
and at this point, I'm dual citizen, New Zealand, Australian, American, and New Zealand is my home at this point. This is my home.
Do you find yourself writing in a way that's been influenced by being in New Zealand? Or are you writing as an American?
It's a funny question because, of course, I was born and raised, it defines a lot of my, worldview. But yet at the same time, and even before I lived in New Zealand, I lived in Japan for about 4.5 years before coming to New Zealand. So I have a very altered worldview from having lived in Japan, where I spoke a little Japanese and learned a lot while I was there, but very different culture from the kind of Anglo culture I knew growing up. And so when I came to New Zealand, it felt, oh, this is more familiar, but yet it's not. So on the surface, it can seem, yeah, sure, it's a predominantly at least English speaking culture, but it's they're culturally very, very different. Whereas in Japan, the cultural difference was always in my face. And here it's more subtle, but very much there. So in terms of my writing, New Zealand has had a huge impact on my writing. My first book was a memoir about the first 4 years of my life living in rural New Zealand, when my partner and I moved out to a lifestyle block in the Wairarapa, just outside Martinborough, where we have about 500 olive trees. So here I was, my partner and I being two American city boys, knowing nothing about olives, knowing nothing about living in rural New Zealand. And we really made a lot of very hilarious mistakes. So that book actually started as a blog where I was writing about our misadventures, making fun of myself, changing my neighbors' names and poking gentle fun at them as well. It became a surprisingly popular blog, it won some awards. And then eventually I crafted that content into a book, which was published by Random House New Zealand in 2013. And that book became a bestseller in New Zealand. It was on the bestseller list for 6 weeks and rose to number four. And I got quite a good amount of press on that. That was a real joy to write, and very much about my love affair with rural New Zealand and the animals, the chickens, and we got some pet pigs, the cattle and sheep on the property. It's a love letter really to the Wairarapa, that book is.
There you are. That sounds wonderful. But let's go back to this business about the beta readers, because I'm wondering, do you get different feedback, and do your beta readers notice different things, the readers in New Zealand as opposed to the readers in America?
That's an interesting question. Don't know. It's so hard to identify that because, is it because of their personalities and then their reading habits, or is it because of their country? There are so many variables. Is it their gender? Is it their, so many things? There's so many variables that I haven't yet noticed a trend of different feedback between the New Zealanders and the Americans in my beta reader pool. There's only 8 beta readers, so it's not a big sample. Of those, a handful of Americans, a handful of Kiwis. So I don't know that I've noticed that. I will say that when my first book came out, it was published, the original title in New Zealand, it was published under the title Moon Over Martinborough. In 2013. In 2018, the rights came back to me and I published an international edition. Now, when I published that international edition, I did market research on a website that allows you to test book titles with various audiences. And overseas audiences, especially I targeted the website I used, it's called PickFu. It allowed me to target people by country. So I targeted people in the States. They didn't respond to the title Moon Over Martinborough at all, because of course they didn't know Martinborough. So they didn't know it as a wine growing region. So it didn't have that kind of same appeal or familiarity. And the book that tested well with Americans, the title that tested well, was An Olive Grove at the Edge of the World. And that is now the title of the international edition, An Olive Grove at the Edge of the World. I also did edits to that book to edit it for an international audience. There was a few New Zealand terms which I had to put some more context around so that the humor wasn't lost on people overseas. But interestingly, the book, it did well in New Zealand, but then it also did well when it was published overseas. It went up to number one in New Zealand Travel and also in Animal Humor on Amazon in Australia, as well as an Amazon in the States. So it seems to do well both in New Zealand and abroad.
Yeah, I like that second title, An Olive Grove at the End of the World. It's quite evocative, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, Edge of the World, an Olive Grove at the Edge of the World. I had originally tested the Olive Grove at the End of the World, but some readers thought that sounded post-apocalyptic, so I changed it to the Edge of the World.
Yes, it's an appetite.
Because it's, yes. And it's very different genre, of course, that memoir, very different genre than my sci-fi thriller that I'm working on now. And I have people email me, send me messages on social media. I probably get messages, you know, it's at least once a week about when are you going to write another Olive Grove memoir, which is very sweet. But I'm never say never, but I'm not working on one right now.
No. Tell me about the appetite, or the, is it a fashion? Is it a fad for sci-fi? There's a great appetite for speculative fiction generally, isn't there? What's your view on that? Got any theories?
So one example is Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale, which of course is popular because it's become a television series. And that I think is in its fourth season. The first season dealt with the subject matter of her book, and then it's moved beyond that. That I think has taken a real popular turn because of the parallels in many ways between her book and some of the things that were happening in particular in the States during the Trump presidency. But I do think that science fiction helps us to understand not only changes in our relationship with governments, but also it helps us to understand new technologies like genetic engineering, artificial intelligence. And I think that it's a way, science fiction is a way that we as a human species imagine forward to prepare ourselves to figure things out and solve problems before they hit us so that we can avoid them and have better responses if and when that actually happens.
That's an interesting theory. Although many of the science fiction premises that have been put forward in books in the last 40 years haven't necessarily been, the cautions haven't been taken notice of, have they?
No, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. It's interesting, though, that when you think about cautionary tales, unfortunately, you know, we as a human race don't always heed those cautions. If we did, we would have responded to things like climate change much sooner, for example. I recently rewatched the old movie from the 70s, Soylent Green, and they were talking about climate change in that. And I was amazed because that was in the 70s. So it was part of the popular consciousness, but it's only now that, and even now we're slow with responding. It's only recently that people are starting to take it more seriously.
Yeah. I was wondering whether speculative fiction generally and science fiction particularly relieves the buildup of stress and anxiety, angst, if you like, about the state of the of our futures by reading it, by having the heart quicken at the horror of it all, whatever, however the story goes, it somehow takes the pressure off the reader.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I was recently reading a study of books that became popular during the coronavirus lockdown, the first starting in April 2020. And it was a study of the trends of genres specifically on Amazon globally. And what happened is that lighthearted reading began to become more popular. And while science fiction maintained a steady sales rate, specifically post-apocalyptic fiction dropped. So anything that was heavy, those sales dropped. Horror dropped. romantic comedy went up. Lighthearted reading humor was through the roof during the lockdown, and it was predominantly, the study came out of lockdown in the US and the UK.
Wow.
Yeah. So people needed a break.
Yes, understandably. Yes.
Yes.
We all need a break. Now, at NPR, we often go for a break halfway through, sort of. I'm rather arbitrary about when halfway is. But let's do that now, because when you come back, I'd very much like you to do a reading.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you.
That'd be grand. So this is Rachel Doré talking to Jared Gullion about his authorship and all kinds. We're going to talk about all sorts of other stuff and about his new book, The Last Beekeeper. So Words from the Bubble is about to go for a break. So we'll be back in a minute.
Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.
You're back with Rachel Doré on NPR, talking with Jared Gullion. And Jared, you're going to do a reading. Now, what are you reading from?
I'm going to read from the prologue of The Last Beekeeper, which is my upcoming science fiction thriller. It's on pre-order now on Amazon and will be published in July.
Great.
So this is from the very opening. So here we go. Emmett Jones didn't know where the noise was coming from or exactly what it was, but he'd never heard anything like it before in the End Woods. The sound reverberated among the darkening trees that surrounded him, a low-pitched, constant hum punctuated with something that sounded like an intermittent clicking. This was not a gentle noise. It sounded almost, well, malicious. At 78, Emmett knew his hearing wasn't what it used to be, but he also knew that this sound was just not right. He looked around the woods, trying to identify the source. The trees on either side of him were tinted with shadows. From this spot, the evening sky had been reduced to a single indigo line which cut through the canopy, mirroring the rugged track at his feet. He hadn't paid attention to the time, but it was now just past sunset. He had no flashlight. When the last of the light was gone, it would be impossible to see. His eyes were already struggling in the gloom. His dog, Sandy, was up ahead, an energetic yellow lab. He looked at her and felt some comfort to have her with him. He picked up his pace. Every evening, he walked this track with Sandy, so they both knew it well. This was the old access that hunters used, just two ruts worn from years of tires passing through. Locals called it Miller's Track for reasons nobody remembered now, not even Emmett. Grass grew between the tire ruts. It was the only thing remotely resembling a road out here. Normally, Emmett's walk went like clockwork. He always left an hour before sunset and came home in twilight. But earlier this evening, he'd stopped to watch the sky turn orange above the treetops, and he must have watched it a bit longer than he'd thought. It happened sometimes now. He'd lose entire mornings, and afternoons would occasionally disappear as though they'd evaporated. For Emmett, time had become a malleable, changeable thing. The hum continued, rising and falling like a strange, long thunder. The clicks echoed against the trees. The sound seemed to come from every direction at once. Could it be a machine? Was someone doing some work out here at this hour? Hello, he called out hopefully, in spite of the fact that he rarely came across anyone in these woods. There weren't many people on the island after all, and there weren't many people who came into these woods, especially at this time of day. Up ahead, Sandy appeared as a pale spot among the shadows. He loved that dog. She was almost too much for him, really, with her endless need to be outside and moving, but he believed she kept him young, kept the fire in his belly. She needed him. It was important to be needed. She'd been sniffing around for a bit, but now she stopped, looked off to the left, and growled. "What's out there, girl?" he asked. His voice was strong but gravelly. Everyone told Emmett he was a feisty old man, and he always took it as a compliment. He didn't ever want to be the kind to sit back and die. It was like the poem said, the one he'd copied out and pinned to his corkboard at home, "Do not go gentle into that good night." He kept busy. He still worked part-time at the hardware store because he liked to see people. He cared for his garden and fruit trees with a kind of obsessive joy, and he made jams and jellies from the bounty. He tinkered with old radios in the garage to pass the time. He'd never married, never had kids. He'd had a series of dogs, though, and had long ago come to the conclusion that good dogs like Sandy were all the companionship a man needed in this world. When folks on Gull Island asked Emmett what kept him going, he always talked about these evening walks with Sandy. He'd seen other people his age become stuck in the house with bad knees and hips. For Emmett, that would be a fate worse than death. He always said, "When I'm too old to walk, I'm too old to live," and he meant it. Now, as quickly as the noise had started, it stopped. The woods were deathly silent. There was no evening bird song. There was no rustle of little critters in the brush. He didn't waste any time. He began walking as fast as he could, almost running, or as close to running as his weary legs would allow. There were two possibilities in his mind. Either he was being a silly old man, or he wasn't. He didn't much care. Either way, he wanted nothing more than to get home, to sit in his armchair with a good book before the rest of the darkness fell. There was something new and not entirely normal in these woods tonight. And for the first time in his life, he felt uneasy out here. Ooh. And it goes on a bit with the prologue.
Ooh, that's
a bit of atmospheric, I think.
Atmospheric, yes. Yes. And very picturesque. I mean, you know, you can see it. Yes.
It's interesting that, you know, my living in rural New Zealand and walking, just going on long walks, you know, through the paddocks and down to the river, and there's a big stretch of bush down by the river, and just walking through there, and my connection with the natural world has really influenced my writing in a lot of ways, even when this particular scene is set in the States on a small island in Lake Michigan. In my heart, it's still very much influenced by my relationship with rural New Zealand.
Ah, that's an interesting thing to say. So you were brought up in an urban environment then?
I was brought up in a very suburban environment, but interestingly, and I didn't realize this until I started living in rural New Zealand. Wherever I've lived, I've always sought out as much nature as I could find. Mm-hmm. So when I lived in the suburbs outside Detroit, there was an area, a field behind some homes across the way that I used to go explore. And when I lived in Minnesota for a while, again in a suburb, there was some woods behind the school that I used to go for walks in. But I never realized how important that was to me until I came to New Zealand. And I'm so, where we are now in the Wairarapa, I'm so surrounded by natural beauty. And I realized, wow, I've always sought this out and I never put it together. But I've also realized in writing this book, this sci-fi thriller, you know, as I say, it takes place on a remote island in Lake Michigan, and the protagonist has gone there to experience a sense of safety. And I didn't honestly realize till I was quite a way through this book that, you know, I've come to New Zealand, an island or islands in the South Pacific, and especially through this pandemic, I've had such a strong sense of safety being here because we've fared so well that the safety I feel in New Zealand is very akin to the safety that this particular protagonist feels on this small island in Lake Michigan.
Ah, yes. And it's a safety that's about to be undermined by strange events. There's a lot of tension in that. How interesting. And this is coming out in July, you say?
Yes, it's mid-July now. Although it's available, the ebook is available for pre-order now on Amazon. But the actual publication will come out in July, and the ebook will be in July, and the print book will be slightly after that.
Who's doing your cover?
I've hired a group through some independent author forums. I've found a group called Books Covered. They're based in the UK, and they specialize in books for independent authors. And their cover designers, who Stuart Besh is the main cover designer there, and they have had a lot of experience in traditional publishing. So they apply that experience to indie authors. I've also had an editor who's got experience in traditional sci-fi publishing in London has done the editing for me. And I've worked with her on several drafts of the novel. And her name is Emily Yao, and she has been amazing at helping me to make the book the best that it can be.
Wow. Yeah, it's important, isn't it, to make the book the best it can be. That's exactly it. That's the name of the game.
It's been a very much an international effort in many ways. My proofreader is here in New Zealand, a cover designer in the UK, a developmental editor, story editor in the UK, in London, Emily, as I mentioned, and beta readers both in New Zealand and in the US. So it's been an international effort.
It is, it is. So how far into your second book in the series are you?
Well, I have probably about maybe a quarter of it written, and I've got an outline for it, and I've got more vague outlines for book three and four. And I, as I say, I think it will be four books, but who knows when I get to four, if it will be more or not. We'll see how it carries me.
Yes, yes. So outlines. So you're an outliner, a plotter and a planner, are you?
Well, interestingly, I never used to be. And I took through in Wellington through the International Institute of Modern Letters. They have a summer fiction workshop that I took a few years back. And it's just a short intensive fiction workshop. And what they do is with the sister school at Iowa Workshop, they bring over a graduate from Iowa Workshop to Wellington every year. And that writer teaches the course. So I took the course with Curtis Sittenfeld, and I had never written an outline. And Curtis Sittenfeld wrote Prep, and her book out now is called Hillary. It's a kind of a fictional account of Hillary Rodham Clinton. And I take that back. It's called Rodham, I believe. But she's an amazing writer, New York Times bestseller, and all that. She made us write at least one sentence for every chapter of our novels that we were working on at the time. And I resisted that like you wouldn't believe, because I always felt like I wanted to discover it as I went through it. What she said was, it's okay to change it. Just write the outline. You can change as you go. You're not stuck with it. But she said, it helps you write faster and it helps you to finish. And she said, in my experience, the people that she graduated from the Iowa Workshop with, she said, it's not always the best writers who become successful. It's the ones who finish and produce their books. And she said, this helps you do that. So I followed that advice. And the other thing she taught me was that I should write the first draft, never go back and rework the first chapter until you're at the end of the book. Her rule was, if you realize in chapter five that back in chapter one, you should have done A instead of B, you take notes, you write it down in chapter one, A should happen instead of B, but you write forward as if you'd made the change in chapter one. So you continue. Yeah, it's a great technique, which I now use, because you just keep going, because I can easily get caught up in that editing and re-editing and re-editing. And it can slow you down quite a bit. But if you wait till you get to the end of the novel, and then what happens is you have a novel that's essentially unreadable because you may have changed things as you go through. But then you go through, you do a second sweep, and you fix all those things based on your notes. But by that point, you've gotten to the end, so you know how the story arc goes, and you can be much more effective in your edits, and it helps you get through it faster and avoid the constant quagmire of editing that many writers get caught in.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting advice. Very interesting advice. So actually, in the first draft, with those guidelines, one sentence per chapter, you and knowing that you can make changes, you've actually got the best of both worlds, really. You've got a base structure, and then you write your heart out, and in your revision, go back and make those changes that you've taken notes for. Yeah.
Yes.
It makes a
lot. I have what I call a zero draft. So my zero draft is the one where I've made all the notes that, oh, go back and change this, and they should have done that instead of this. So my zero draft is that kind of note-filled draft. And then once I go through and make those revisions, then that's, for me, that's draft one.
There we go. Some great tips. Great tips for listeners who are writing or about to. Very good. Would you like to read a little more?
I would be happy to. There's a sort of thrilling conclusion to this prologue. Let me skip ahead a little bit. What essentially happens is that while Emmett is walking with his dog, he then, Sandy, the dog, suddenly bolts off into the woods, and Emmett goes running after the dog, and he gets into the darkness of the trees, and it continues like this. It seemed that there was something up ahead, an empty area with fewer trees. There was a slightly brighter, dusky light up there. He walked as quickly as he could now to get away from these dense trees and out from under the heavy canopy. Anything could be hiding in the shadows. He found himself in a clearing. In the dying light, he could make out a fallen tree in the middle of the open space with low ferns and shrubs nearby. The woods made a dark circle around him. Even the trunks of the trees were barely visible among the shadows. He stood there for a moment, watching the darkness. The sound of the hum and click began to grow slowly again. It was heavy and deep. This was no machine. This was no coyote. He couldn't tell himself stories anymore just to make him feel better. This was something much worse. It was getting closer. Where was it coming from? He looked left, then right. Sandy, he whispered. There was no sign of his dog. Nothing showed through the dense canopy beyond the clearing, not even small fragments of the dusky light. The noise came even closer. Was it at the edge of the clearing? He turned around. Something shifted in the undergrowth to his left. There was a loud crack, like a tree branch breaking. He turned to face whatever it was, holding a stick high. He would not be taken down by some dumb, hungry animal in these woods. He would beat the crap out of it if he had to. His heart was beating fast. His breathing was shallow. There was nothing to be seen in this direction but the blue-black shadows of the brush. The sound continued, as though it was coming from everywhere. He scanned the trees again, and that was the moment he realized that he'd become disoriented. Which direction was Miller's track? How would he find his way back? Sandy? His voice was shaking. Sandy? The fading light was starting to cast dark shapes in the gloom. Then he heard branches quickly breaking again. Something was running. Whatever it was heading in his direction. He gripped the stick tightly, trembling. Sandy? It hit him hard and fast, knocking him to the ground. It was on top of him, pinning him down. He fought fiercely, pounding it with his fists, the stick having fallen to his side. It was no coyote. There was no fur. It had arms. Its skin felt thick and tough. It was too strong. It was too big. It was smothering him. He couldn't even fill his lungs enough to scream.
Ooh.
That's the end of the prologue.
Wow. Wow. Okay. That is very gripping. So it's a sci-fi thriller.
It is. With monsters. It takes a while to figure out what's going on, but I've always been interested in the idea of monsters. And you know, when you think about you know, our long history with literature and monsters, you think back to Grendel, you know, and the epic poem Beowulf, seven hundred. Grendel was a creature of darkness, exiled from happiness. And we have a long history as human readers and story listeners and storytellers, a long history of fascination with monsters. And I think that monsters teach us a lot about our own fears and the way we respond to fears.
Yes, definitely. Now, when we spoke yesterday before, you know, getting to know one another a bit, you were mentioning you'd quite like to have a couple of words about the publishing industry. Now, was that the publishing, the status of publishing in New Zealand or generally? And a question hooked with that one is, why self-publishing this novel after you've been successfully published by, you know, by a trade publisher in the past?
It's interesting that the dilemma that I have had as an author and looking at the publishing industry, you know, my experience with traditional publishing was fantastic. My publishers of my first book, the New Zealand edition of the olive farming memoir that was titled Moon Over Martinborough, that was an amazing experience. And I was so grateful for everything, and especially all the good media that I received, the great publicity that the publisher helped me get. And as I started looking, I started reading about self-publishing, and you know, the argument from a lot of self-published authors that two things really, that one, they didn't like to give up their IP. You know, their creative work is something that they have developed, that to give that over to anyone else was very difficult for them because they lost control of how it could be used and reused. Often publishing contracts require that there's often some vague language around any distribution in any current forms or any forms yet to be created. So there's this big sort of broad sweeping statements about the way a work can be published or republished. That's one. And two is just the argument that comes up around royalties. So for example, an independent author publishing can keep 70% of the royalties, 70, whereas traditionally, if you're published through a traditional publisher, it's usually much less, you know, 10 to 15% or something like that. Independently published authors do have to do their own marketing, but it's actually, with the tools that are available now, it's not hard to do your own marketing through Facebook ads and your own marketing through Amazon ads as well. It's also not hard to find, you know, editors to help you edit your book to make sure that it has a professional quality, and also cover designers to help you with cover design. Some of the there are, of course, the occasional self-published author that doesn't go through that kind of rigor with their work, but that is happening less as the standards for self-publishing are raised. And I know some authors now who have been able to quit their day job through self-publishing that they are unlikely to have been able to do through traditional publishing because they keep so much of the royalties, and because they also are in control of where the book can be published and republished. So I think that if the goal is to earn your living from writing, it's actually more the opportunities are greater as far as I can see, in self-publishing than in traditional publishing, unless you're J.K. Rowling or Stephen King. Of course, those authors, it's a different story altogether.
Yeah, that's different, very different, in fact. Yes. And a lot of people are writing series as well, yes, because that's kind of a marketing strategy to have a series so that your name gets repeated, I guess, as well as books.
That's very true. And there are a lot of readers who love series, and so there's a huge demand for series. I took a self-publishing course online through a group called the Self-Publishing Formula. There's a thriller writer named Mark Dawson, who's a British thriller writer, who was traditionally published and now self-publishes his thrillers. And he earns a very good living through his self-published thrillers. And he provides, it's called Self-Publishing 101, a course where you can learn how to do your own self-publishing. And then he also has a course on Facebook ads and Amazon ads. So everything I learned, I learned online, but I love to learn. Being a self-published author is much more like running your own creative business, because I'm, I keep tabs on what I spend for advertising and what I'm getting from income. I also use a group called Ingram Spark, so that I can have global print-on-demand publishing as well, so that my paperbacks can be available online through Barnes and Noble Walgreens and other bookstores. The paperback is also available online. So I have a mix of how I publish, but it's really like running your own business. And some people don't like that. I actually enjoy the challenge of running ads and figuring out the most effective ad and getting people to find my book in creative means doing that.
That's very, very interesting and useful for people listening as well. Just repeat for me, please, that self-publishing course that you did.
What was it called? It's Mark Dawson. If you Google Mark Dawson self-publishing formula, you'll find the Self-Publishing 101, which is the first course I took. There are advanced courses for Facebook and Amazon ads. But the self-publishing formula, it's through Mark Dawson. If you Google that, there's also a free podcast, so you can listen to the Self-Publishing Formula podcast. It's a weekly podcast where they interview different independent authors. It's a fantastic podcast. I started with that, and I started learning a bit about that. It's a good entry into self-publishing just by listening to that.
Great. You've given us a real basket of goodies. Thank you so much, Jared.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. I love talking about books and writing. So,
yeah, I can tell. It's been wonderful. And all the best for The Last Beekeeper. I expect you'll be posting on Facebook when that's due. And you're going to have a launch and do all that formal stuff.
And in fact, I've got right now on my website at jaredgulian.com, that's J-A-R-E-D, Gulian, G-U-L-I-A-N. I'm giving away the first four chapters of that novel for free in ebook. So anybody who signs up for my author newsletter can get those first four chapters of The Last Beekeeper, and also a free short story about one of the crazy antics that happened on our olive farm, a short story called The Strange Case of the Chicken Assassin.
very good. All right. Thank you. You've been a generous guest.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm honored to be a part of it. Thank you.
Thank you. And just keep us all posted. So you
can come
back anytime. This is Rachel DeRay saying farewell to Jared Gulian. And for the rest of you, Words from the Bubble will be back next week. See you all later.